Welcome to Pages to Pictures from the Oakey Bookcast. My name is Jay Hall, and I'm on a mission to connect curious readers like you with your next great read. Pages to Pictures is a little bit different kind of conversation for the bookcast, where I invite a guest to join me for a deep dive into a screen adaptation of a book we love. You can find earlier episodes of the show at oakeybookcast.com/pages to pictures. This time around, I'm joined once again by podcaster Jamie Ray to talk about a Stephen King adaptation that proved to be one of the defining films of the 80s. It's time for Spandex, Mick Fleetwood, and all the catchphrases you can handle. That's right, we're taking on The Running Man. Here we are with my buddy, podcaster, high-demand Comic-Con personality, and all-around decent guy, Jamie Ray. Jamie, what's up, man?
Oh, sorry. I thought there was another guest coming on before me.
Sorry. Our apologies to Matt Damon. We've run out of time.
No,
what's
man,
going on, Jamie?
I am doing fantastic, buddy. I'm doing some cons this year, which has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I went down to Fan Expo New Orleans at the beginning of the year and met some incredible people, did my first panel. And then followed that a couple of weeks later with my first live podcast.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's really exciting. I had last week, I don't know if you saw this, big news. I was number 92 in Antigua and Barbados.
That's outstanding.
TV and film podcasts.
Yes. That is incredible.
Isn't it? I mean, just I'm not going to remember the little folks like you, though, when I.
Well, know. Honestly, that's where you should do your next live show is just go down to Antigua.
What?
And spend some time on the beach, do a live Fave Five from Fans.
Yeah, I don't go to the beach that often because the natives try to push me back into the water. But they're nice people, so, you know.
Well, okay, so speaking of, before we get into The Running Man, and oh, are we going to get into The Running Man?
Oh, my God.
Tell everybody real quick, remind us about Fave Five from Fans.
Well, it is a show all about favorites. And what I do is I invite someone who's a friend or a new friend or a stranger. But we talk about favorites. So we pick a topic and we both make blind lists of our Fave Five of those, and we'll give you anywhere between 1 and 76 honorable mentions.
Thank you.
Not pointing at anybody. And then we sit down and compare them 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And because the show the theme out there is top or best or whatever, I don't go for that because I like its favorites because it's all about the stories.
Yeah.
And what I may think is really, really bad, you love because it was the first movie your grandparents took you to. I don't know. It's just a lot of fun. And you and I have, I mean, you know, you're a member of the Six Club.
Yes, I am. Oh, it's so fun to be on.
But the show's a lot of fun, and I love us. And we've got some stuff coming up for 2024 that we're going to do that's going to be a lot of fun. I just wrangled you into something else now.
Yeah, you did.
That I'm looking forward to doing.
You wrangled me into being a fashion critic.
Yes, I did.
So there's the teaser for you, folks. Jay and Jamie talking fashion.
Oh, God.
Mark your calendars. It's going to be that good.
Speaking of fashion, woo, man.
Okay, so we're going to talk about The Running Man. Now, here's the first question I have to ask you, Jamie, because when we talked about you coming back on, and by the way, if Jamie's voice is familiar, he joined me back in November for the Pages to Pictures conversation about Murder on the Orient Express. So when we talked about coming back on, I said, let's do Stephen King. And I gave you 4 or 5 options.
Yes.
And out of those 4 or 5 options, you chose The Running Man.
Yes.
Why?
Dude, are you kidding me? It's a story. Okay, it's not just a story from Stephen King. It's the story from the dark mind half of Stephen King
right?
Called Richard Bachman. I mean,
yeah.
This is the stories that he can't even put his own name on. Okay. And not just that, the movie is an 80s action smorgasbord feast of puns, one-liners, and just, oh, it's so awesome.
It is the 80s movies that has ever 80s.
I think you are correct, sir.
It's unbelievable.
Now, there are maybe other movies of his that I like more. or maybe other books that I've read more often. But when it came down to that list, that one jumps out at me because there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, this conversation, just settle in, folks. I have no idea how long it's going to be, but I bet it's going to take a minute because there's a lot to talk about here. The first challenge of talking about The Running Man as a film adaptation is trying to just get the story out because the movie and the book are so very different. So rather than try to tell the story of each, which just would take forever, Jamie, give us kind of just a quick 30,000 foot view of the world that King as Richard Bachman created in which The Running Man takes place.
First of all, it's set right in our modern times. I think it was 2017.
Yeah. 2017.
And there's been a breakdown and there's the government has started kind of melding in with the network TV shows. And there's a lot of stuff going on where there's not enough food around. It's very kind of Soylent Green there, you know, and the government / media are trying to do everything they can to keep people from noticing that they're hungry or noticing that they're doing without things. And so they come up with this TV show called The Running Man. Basically, the show is exactly what it sounds. You've got a guy and he runs from people. The show is set up so that they take a contestant. He has to go through four quadrants of, I think it's a 400 block radius.
Yeah, that's what they say.
While he has stalkers chasing him. And he has 3 hours to go to all four and then he wins. That's where we are. These people are watching it like we watch the Super Hockey Bowl that we're at coming up.
And such a sports guy, Jamie Ray.
Right.
So the book essentially is set in the same kind of world, right? That the government has merged, I think it's a good way of saying it, merged with the media. They're using it to control people, basically to have them just sit around and be happy, but also to, in the book, to give them hope that if they could get on these shows, they might have a chance to make a lot of money and make something of themselves. But the media that's been created it's pretty dark.
Pretty dark.
Because the whole deal about The Running Man is that if you're caught, they kill you, right? That's how you end it. And in both the book and the film, they have kind of these teasers about other shows that exist. So in the movie, you have the one where the guy's climbing the rope and it's called Climbing for Dollars or whatever, but he's being hounded literally by these vicious attack dogs.
Yes.
And if he falls off the rope, well, then things aren't going to be good. And in the book, in one of the more twisted things I think Stephen King's ever written about, there is a show where they put people with asthma and heart conditions on a treadmill.
Treadmill to bucks.
And the longer they last, the more money they make. But ultimately, that goes the direction you think it might go. So if you haven't seen or read The Running Man, dystopian world set in, well, the movie set in 2017, the book set in 2025. I don't know why they made a change. Media, you've got this show that basically is about running and not being caught because if you get caught, bad things are going to happen.
Right.
Now, things are going to get wildly divergent and we will get into that in a minute. But before we do, let me just tell you, I'll give you a little bit of background on the book, and then Jamie's going to talk a little bit about the movie from a background perspective. The book was written in 1982 by, as we've said, Stephen King under his then pseudonym Richard Bachman, which is kind of the name he used for some of his more complicated works. Can we say it that way?
Yeah.
But also, I think some of the works that he wrote that were really more geared toward making comments about the government. So The Running Man has a lot to say about the government. The Long Walk has a ton to say about the government and kind of control and what people are willing to do and what the government's willing to do. King said he wrote it in a week, which is very different for him. Most of his work is, he says he writes a couple thousand words a day, which means it'll take, I think he says, 3 months to write a novel. This one he sat down and he wrote in a week, and he describes it, and I love this, he describes it as a book written by a young man who was angry, energetic, and infatuated with the art and the craft of writing. And when you read The Running Man, you can feel the anger towards institutions, towards the government, towards the media. But I will say all of that, the book's fantastic. I think it's a great book. It's a great story. The characters are really interesting. The progression, it's very fast. It reads very fast, which shouldn't be surprising given a book called The Running Man. From the Jump, fantastic book. But get in your head, early 80s. 1982 is when he's writing this, and that feeds into where we go from here. So, Jamie, tell us a little bit about how that got adapted into a movie.
Like you said, it was written back in 82. The man who bought the rights to the book, it was one of five novels that Bachman had used that pen name?
I think by that point, yeah.
Yeah. So it was a first-time producer named George Linder who fell in love with the book, and he optioned it for the movie not long after it was published. It was late 82, early 83. He paid $20,000 to option the film and $100,000 for the movie right, not knowing it was a Stephen King novel.
Now, wow.
You talk about a good deal. He got a good deal for that.
Worked out pretty well for him, yeah.
Yes. So they got together and they went through a couple of different directors until they settled on Detective Dave Starsky from Starsky and Hutch. Right. It was Paul Michael Glazer.
That's right.
So, of course, at this point, they were, the cat was out of the bag that it was Stephen King. So both Stephen King and Stephen DeSouza,
yeah,
Die Hard, Commando, and I found out Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man episodes.
Yeah. It was a TV writer in the 70s.
Yeah. They got together and hammered out a script, and they were actually looking at Christopher Reeve very early on to play it. But after 2 weeks, the original director was fired because they had like different views of it. When Paul Michael Glazer came in, he kind of walked away from that single solitary man
right
phase to turning it into an 80s action film. And of course, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was signed on, oh my God, it was so on.
Became a very different kind of thing.
And then it pretty much went in, had a budget of $27 million. It was
mostly on spandex.
Mostly. It released in just under 1,700 theaters and grossed $8 million over the first weekend. And total domestic gross was $38 million. Sadly, there's been no sequel.
So let's get into this as an adaptation. Because there's so much to talk about.
There's so little to talk about.
From an adaptation perspective, Well, when we get to the differences, we can settle in for a minute or 20. Now, remember, as we talk about this, we're gonna do spoilers. This has been around a while. It's no mystery.
Murder on the Orient Express has been around longer than this has. And
Murder on the Orient Express is a mystery novel. It's literally a whodunit, and you were going to tell him who did it.
Yes, I was. All right. I mean, sorry. Let's go back.
No one's going to be shocked to learn that Arnold Schwarzenegger walks away with a cigar in his mouth and a girl in his arm at the end of Running Man. I mean, that's
what
every movie that ever was written. So we're going to spoil a little bit. And the other thing, I always want to say this. We're going to talk about what they got right, what they got wrong, what worked and what didn't. This is our opinion. We're just two guys talking it out. You may have a completely different view, and that's awesome. And I would love for you to jump on social media and just let's have that conversation about it. But when we say right, just know that we're not making judgment calls other than just our opinions about what we think of it. And it is important to note that we are both children of the 80s. And so we're going to have kind of a certain affection for certain things in this movie that a more discerning palate might not appreciate. Is that a safe way to say that?
That's a very safe way to say that.
All right. So enough disclaimers. Let's get into this. Jamie, when you think about the book and the film as an adaptation of the book, what did they get right?
The title.
Yes. That's one.
His name.
One of their names.
Yeah, only Ben's name.
Only Ben's name, because Killian, he has a different first name in the movie.
Oh, that's true, he does, yeah.
He's Dan in the book and Damon, because that just sounded more TV for Richard Dawson in the film.
And they also got the country right. And they did both run at one point.
There was running. There was running involved, hence the title working out. I think there's a couple of other things. There aren't very many. But as we mentioned, I think they They do a good job in both of describing this dystopian world that's kind of emerged out of the government taking a lot of things over. I think while the Running Man show is very different on the two different pieces, the fact that it exists, it's popular, that there is this kind of tie between the media and the government and things are a little bit shady there, that all sets up both ways. Now, where they go with it becomes very different very quickly.
Right.
The other big thing that happens in both the film and the book, major spoiler alert, prepare yourself, Killian dies.
He doesn't just die.
No, he doesn't just die. We'll get to that. He goes in spectacular fashion, which you would expect. Bang. Thank you. Both of them. It's just a different bang each time. But you're right. There is very little. Now, you mentioned that Ben Richards is Ben Richards in both the book and the movie. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about characters for a second.
Okay.
When you think about the book, you think about the movie, there aren't a lot of crossover characters.
No.
Or the ones that do exist in both, how'd they do?
They adapted it in a way that is perfectly not right.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. I just, as we think about these characters, the ones that do cross over from one to the next, they could not have been more different than the way they're presented in the book.
Right. I did, because I will say now, which is obviously why I picked it, I absolutely love this book.
Yeah.
There are some passages in this book that when I was rereading it again, I almost felt like I remember reading it before.
And nice.
A perfect example of what Ben Richards from the book is, at one point he's trying to escape into a series of pipes under a YMCA. Yes. And he actually mutters at one point, "Thank God I'm underfed," which to me says exactly how he looked.
Yeah.
Then you have Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is, I mean, at this point in his career, he was an Adonis.
He was jacked.
God, he was something else. And he was a former cop.
Right.
Who had military training in the movie and stuff like this. So the character in the book was just a guy, a new father, a husband. So those two characters could not have been more different, unless you'd made one of them a woman.
Well, and I think that was part of the, you know, we talked about when they made the switch away from Christopher Reeve to Schwarzenegger. I think that's part of it, because the goal was originally to have a more faithful adaptation, which Christopher Reeve could have done. I mean, he's Superman, but he wasn't this larger than life action hero kind of person. And in the book, he's Superman, but you know what I mean.
No, I knew. Thank you. The actor could have definitely slimmed down.
Because, in the book, Richards, I mean, they're starving. They're poor. The reason he goes on the show is because he needs to get money, because his family is in trouble. His daughter's sick. Mm-hmm. And then, Richard Dawson actually says at one point he's in love with those biceps when he sees Schwarzenegger running.
Yes.
Because he's massive. So, Schwarzenegger was not going to fit into the pipes under the YMCA. And by the way, that was brilliantly claustrophobic.
What?
The way that was written when he goes under there, wow.
And the way the pipe starts to heat up and, oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Good so stuff. Good. Yeah. Good stuff. Okay, so Schwarzenegger, not even close. What about Killian?
Killian, not even close. Dan Killian in the book is... And I had to go back and reread his description, because at first I thought he was a rather large man. But when I went back to read it again, he says he's a medium build.
Right.
But he's a dark skinned man.
Yeah. And it almost gets uncomfortable as King or Bachman is describing him, because he goes so hard into describing how dark skinned Killian is.
He is very eloquent and has a boisterous laugh. And I think that is different in that I think Richard Dawson, who plays him as Damon Killian, is all fake.
Right.
The only time you ever see him, I think when he breaks that illusion is when the Attorney General calls.
Right.
And he gets everybody out of the room.
Yeah.
So I think those were both vastly different. And in the book, even though we know he's a bad guy, there are, like, when he gives Ben some money
right
early on so that he could send it to his family, it kind of makes you wonder, is he kind of trying to be a nice guy, or is he hedging his bets because he knows this is the guy who might actually go all the way?
Yeah.
Or what? But again, they could not have been more different.
Well, and they also, just even their roles, you know, in the film, Richard Dawson is up front. He's the host of the show. I mean, he's Richard Dawson, right?
Yes.
He's just Richard Dawson as Damon Killian. In the book, he's a behind the scenes guy. Mm-hmm. He's not the host. He doesn't show up. He's like a studio executive for the network,
right,
which is why he is in the building at the end of the book. But it's like they looked at the characters in the book and said, what is the opposite that we could do of these? And we're going to put that on the screen.
Yes.
Somebody call Arnold. Here we go. So the other big difference in the characters is the nature of the people that are hunting the running man.
Yes.
Right. So
in the book,
they're called hunters, and they're more like spy, detective, secret agent dudes that are using, you know, intelligence and the different kind of tracking things that they find to hunt Ben down. In the movie, Jamie, tell us about the stalkers.
Oh my God. Okay. So before we get into that, one of the major things that I thought in the movie that did a major disservice was the fact that when they strip Richards down, they give him like a shot between his fingers.
Right.
They give him like a tracking fluid that they put in his body. It's like they know exactly where he is at all times. They don't do that in the book.
Right.
In the book, they just let him out into
it's a legit game.
It is. And he can go wherever he wants to go, wherever in the world. They can't track him from satellites or wherever. But in the movie, you have people like Fireball, Sub-Zero, Captain Freedom,
gosh.
Dynamo.
No, thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. So you've got a mixture of wrestlers and former American football style people. Jim Brown.
Yeah, Jim Brown.
Oh my God, they're so flamboyant. You've got a guy, okay, he's Fireball, and he shoots out with a flamethrower, and he's got a cool rocket pack. Then you've got another guy, they call him Professor Sub-Zero.
Professor Sub-Zero.
Yep. But later on, he's just Sub-Zero. Jesse Ventura is Captain Freedom, who ain't got time to bleed.
The governor of Minnesota, right?
The governor of Minnesota. Two governors in this movie.
That's right. We had the future governor of California and Minnesota in The Running Man.
Yep. And then you've as Dynamo, you've got Erlen Van Leef, who was a classically trained baritone opera singer.
What was that guy doing?
So you've got all of these characters who are just, I mean, they're TV characters.
They're comic book characters.
Yeah, they are.
They're like comic villains.
Don't forget Sven. We can't forget Sven. who ends up, after rewatching it, I watched it again last night just to get ready. I love Sven. He doesn't have many lines, but oh my God, he's so awesome.
Yeah, and has kind of a pivotal, he becomes the representation of the people turning against not only Killian, but kind of the whole setup.
Yes.
And so, you know, you get this sense at the end of the movie that revolution is coming.
Right.
The other thing that I don't want us to miss, so we talked about Jim Brown, we've talked about Jesse the Body Ventura, we talked about these other folks. Mick Fleetwood is in this movie.
Not just Mick Fleetwood, but also Dweezil Zappa.
Dweezil Zappa, yeah. And Mick Fleetwood as Mick Fleetwood, like he's playing himself.
He is. I love that.
In the future, after like the man has shut him down, and so he's the king of the underground.
Yes.
Leading this rebellion, and it's just... like, man, you look at these people and I'm sure it was a check, but Jim Brown's an NFL Hall of Famer and he's wandering around in spandex shooting off a flamethrower with spiked up kid and play hair with white streaks in it.
But Fireball probably had the coolest, most normal costume.
Oh, yeah, easily.
It was all like chainmail, but so it wasn't, but that hair. I mean, yes, I'm jealous.
High top fade, man. High top fade. So, yeah, I think we can pretty safely say that the characters, as we transition into what was different between the two, and oh boy.
Oh boy.
One of the biggest things, I think, is the characters, because you have the stalkers are different. You have the, you know, both of the main characters are in it that are different. You have extra people that are running with Schwarzenegger who aren't in the book. You have a love interest, kind of,
who,
you know, in the weirdest, like, meet cute of all time, I guess, that, you know, Maria Conchita Alonso just kind of shows up as a character that may or may not have been necessary. But again, for Schwarzenegger to leave with a girl in his arm,
it's got to.
It wasn't going to be one of the dancers. It had to be somebody that was a little bit of a bigger name. And speaking of dancers, we cannot miss the ultimate 80s moment, the choreography of the dancers by, do you know?
Paula Abdul.
Paula Abdul. Straight up, now tell me. Here we go.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Jackie Jackson made the music for the pre-show entertainment, like,
you know,
when they're
way.
Dancing and everything, and it was called Paula's Theme.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it was.
That's just perfect. Well, and the closing credits. Do you know who sang the closing credits song?
Yes, I do. Parr. John Parr.
John Parr.
That's it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. As soon as that voice started, my wife and I both went, okay, who is that? And it took about 30 seconds, and then...
St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh, my gosh. So bad. All right, so let's talk then about just differences. And we've talked about some of them already, the different stories, obviously different characters. When you think about things that were different from the book to the film, what are the big ones that jump out other than everything?
Okay, so I actually broke it down for
you. Okay, good.
So first off, location.
Yeah.
Right. In the movie, it's Los Angeles and Bakersfield, versus in the book, it's pretty much New York, but it's called Co-op City.
Right.
And of course, we end up going over to Harding, I think. And then we actually go to Derry, which wouldn't be a Stephen King book if it wasn't Derry.
If we didn't show up in Derry somehow.
Right. Right. So that was one of the things. Another thing, like we talked about, was the game.
Right.
So in the game, you have hunters instead of stalkers, and they were very, I almost thought of them like undercover cops.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah.
And then not just do we hear about Treadmill to Bucks, which you brought up, there's also How Hot Can You Take It?
Oh, that's right.
And Kill Ball, which they don't an ad for, but they talk about how big Killian's office is. You can play Kill Ball in it. The basis of the game is very different. And I have a passage here. The rules are simplicity themselves. You or your surviving family will win 100 new dollars for each hour you remain free. We stake you $4,800 for running money on the assumption that you'll be able to at least stay out for 2 days. The unspent balance is refundable, of course. If you fall, you're giving a 12-hour head start. And if you last 30 days, you win the grand prize, $1 billion new dollars.
Billion. It's a lot of money in new dollars.
Yes, it is.
I guess. I have no idea.
And that's something else that is different in this movie that I thought. So the book, they talk about new dollars versus old dollars, and that some people will only take new dollars and some people only get paid in new dollars and some are old. So at one point, Richards gives a new dollar and gives it to Stacy, a young boy who's helping him. And he stared at it in an awe that was close to horror.
Because he was poor, they didn't have access to new dollars. I think part of the idea of the book is that new dollars was the currency of the wealthy.
Yes. But yet in the movie, they're talking about they're placing bets, and they're placing bets of $200, $300. So that was very different too.
To go back thinking about the nature of the games a little bit, the production of it is obviously very different, right? And part of that's because of the scale. So in the film, basically it's a 400 square block TV studio, although they could seemingly find them on camera anytime, except when they were sneaking around trying to find the underground stuff, which I'm not gonna throw logic at the movie at this point, or in the book, sorry. The stuff that happened on TV was either like just in studio where they were talking about what happened, or every day he had to, he, Ben Richards, had to submit video of him, yeah, twice a day, talking about what he was doing or what's going on. And so part of his strategy was, one, to try to hide where he was. And so he would, you know, set it up against a Blake wall and make sure there weren't sounds in the background, whatever. But also he would talk negatively about the network and the government and what was really going on so that they couldn't use it.
Yeah, exactly. And so you didn't have that until later in the movie when they actually have something to say, because
right.
Killian is doing what they did in the movie, kind of what they did in the book, where they would take what he would say and manipulate it. So right. in the movie, he's working for the police, but he's a good guy who stops when the head ups want him to slaughter a bunch of people who are in a food riot.
Right.
And later on, they recut that video so that it looks like he's the one who decides to go on. Another big problem for me was the motivation for Ben Richards.
Yes, thank you. Go.
Yeah. Okay. So Ben Richards had a wife, Sheila, and a daughter, Catherine, who Catherine was, what, maybe 18 months old.
Yeah, she's young.
Yeah. And she's sick. She has probably what is pneumonia. And Ben has gone from job to job to job and hasn't been able to keep a job because he doesn't work well with authority. So it's gotten to the point where she is taking a turn for the worst, and he decides the only thing he can do is to the Games Authority and try to get on a show.
Right. He wasn't trying to get on The Running Man. He was just trying to get on something.
And he ends up on there, which is another difference. In the books, it's the Game Authority, and in the show, it's ICS Corporation.
Right, right.
Which I could never find what ICS stood for.
Nothing.
Nothing. So when he talks about his daughter, they're asking him, well, you got a kid, so what, was she a mistake? And he says, no, she was planned. A jest of God, maybe. With the world the way it is, I sometimes think we'd have been better off. We would have been off our trolley. So he's got the motivation to save his kid,
yeah.
Not just to the point to save him, to save her. He knows he probably won't survive whatever right. he's doing, but what he's doing will get the money to get to her.
Yep.
So I think that's probably one of the biggest things for me that I thought took some of the heart away from it, because Ben ends up.
Yeah.
doing this because he has to. And it isn't until probably the third act when he's finally saying, okay, well, I see there's a problem bigger than me.
Right.
And I want to do something. Along the way, I thought some of the people that were in the book that got left out, for example, one of my favorite people, was Molly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Molly was an older man who was good at making fake IDs and papers and everything like that, and set him up with a disguise and gave him some really great advice. He said, you know, give yourself a little lip too. Molly advice. He says, not a big attention getter, just a little one. Remember, you have the power to cloud men's minds if you use it, which was just great. Cause you could tell this was a guy kind of like Mick was
right.
in the movie, who was old school, who remembered what it was before it was like it was today. Oh, and finally, the absolute absence of Irish explosives in the movie. So
yes,
on the reread, I totally missed the part that when Richards is in Killian's office and they're talking about some of the things that are going on in the world, and some people don't necessarily like the movies. Richards asks him, would you be afraid somebody might tape a stick of Irish to your ignition system some night? And then it's not until later on, much later on the plane, where he says he's carrying 12 pounds of Dynacor high impact plastic explosives, the variety they call black Irish. Again, like you said, we can make this 3 hours long.
Well, but. And I think the other big, and prepare yourself for spoilers, the other major change from the book to the film is that Richards dies.
Yes.
In the book. So, you know, Killian dies at the end because Schwarzenegger's and fires him down the tube, and he hits a billboard and explodes
into
flame that makes no sense whatsoever. in the book, Killian, like, Richards is on a plane to come back to Killian because Killian's made a deal. He's basically taking the deal that Killian offers in the movie. He takes it in the book. He's on his way back and he realizes he's about to be double crossed. So he throws down on the plane. He takes everybody out, but he is grievously wounded.
Guts hang. He literally trips on his own intestines.
Yes. Yes. He is grievously wounded, but he flies the plane into the tower, into Killian's office, where he is sitting talking to him on the phone. So at the end of the thing, knowing that he's going to die, he knew he wasn't going to survive because he'd been so seriously injured, he summons up everything he can to take Killian out along the way as well, which I think becomes a far more meaningful ending. Maybe not quite as fun, but a far more meaningful ending than, you know, sending Richard Dawson down a water slide into oblivion.
Of course, we didn't talk about the fact that every chapter, it starts off at minus 100 and counting.
Right. Counts down.
And so, yes, counts down. So we finally get down to minus 000 and counting. And it reads, heeling over slightly, the Lockade struck the Games building dead on, three quarters of the way up. Its tanks were still better than a quarter full. Its speed was slightly over 500 miles an hour. The explosion was tremendous, lighting up the night like the wrath of God, and it rained fire 20 blocks away.
Man, that is Stephen King.
That is so Stephen King. And the fact that at minus 001, Killian is sitting at his desk thinking he's got everything wrapped up in a nice bow, and he looks out and he sees the Lockheed TriStar coming straight for him.
Sees the plane coming.
Oh, my God.
Yes. I mean, it is two very different things. In a second, I'm going to ask you the big question about book or movie and where to start. But every time I'm on Fave Five from Fans, I get a curveball that I'm not expecting.
I was waiting for it.
So prepare yourself, because here comes yours. Jamie Ray, if you were a stalker on the film version of The Running Man, what would your shtick be? What would your weapon be?
Man, that's good. I like that.
I got you.
I don't want to do something like the others have done. So it needs to be a little different. It's got to be flamboyant. I think I would be, I'm going to be Sasquatch.
Nice.
Nice. I've got these super hydraulically powered feet that I can walk around and step on people.
Amazing.
Yeah, there you go. Bigfoot.
From the twisted mind of Jamie Ray. So, okay, going with your podcast theme, before we get to which one should people start with, not which one is better, as you think about the book and you think about the movie, which one is your favorite?
The book.
Why?
There's just so many more layers to it. It is a story of an every man.
Yeah.
Who, and every father. I mean, all of us talk about, you know, we do anything for our kids. He does.
Yeah.
I mean, he really does. Without even, I don't think it would be fair to even think that he had a second's doubt when he, after he kisses her and walks out the door. He is set on, I'm going to the Games Authority and I'm going to get some role on some show and I'm going to get money to get my daughter this medicine.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think no matter how great the movie was, the movie just tears everything up. I mean, and I mean that in a good way, you know.
Yeah, totally.
I'll be back. Only in a rerun.
That's right.
Just over.
It's nonstop catchphrases.
Oh my God. It's so delicious. But it doesn't compare to me to that book, because that book has so much heart.
Yeah.
So I would say if you were a child of the 80s, that you definitely, if you haven't seen this movie, you definitely should watch it. Okay. I do think that you're going to roll your eyes. Halfway through the movie,
you won't last that long before you roll your eyes.
What was it? 6 minutes in, and Arnold picks up the guard that suddenly turns into like a stuffed man, not even a mannequin, but like a stuffed mannequin, and he throws it over.
Oh, yeah. Again, I'm going to ask you not to throw logic at this movie because it's not going to work if you do. You're going to lose that fight. Well, let me ask you this, because this is the question we kind of come down to every time. If there is somebody who hasn't read the book, hasn't seen the movie, so they're familiar with what it is, because how can you avoid it? Would you say start with the book, read the book first, watch the movie first?
God, you know, I think I'm going to flip the script here, and I'm going to say to watch the movie first. But
I agree.
You're committed to doing both. So I'm going to tell you to watch the movie first, okay? And just pop some popcorn, sit back, laugh your butt off.
Know what it is and enjoy it. Just embrace it.
Exactly. And then sit down with that book and just delve into it. The grime, the grit of the cities that he goes through. Again, the scene under the YMCA where he's trying to make his escape through the pipes. It's just, it's something else.
You can feel it.
I love the fact that when he gets into the elevator at the YMCA and is sticking that piece of, I don't know, what was it, a toothbrush holder that he had bent in, there was a noise from inside the control panel that sounded like a brief electronic curse. There was a light tingling jolt up his arm for just a moment, nothing else. I mean,
that's good stuff.
Stuff like that is littered throughout this entire book.
Well, and I think the reason to do the movie first, if you read the book, the movie is going to disappoint you
so much
because the book is, it is so good. And because of the themes and things we talked about, if you watch the movie first, the book is only going to delight you more because it is so much better.
Yes.
Just in terms of literary quality and the things that the quotes you've given and just the things we talked about, there's just so much more there. The movie's not going to spoil much of anything from the book. You can enjoy it, I think, more than if you go the other direction.
Yeah. Okay. So on that note, I'm going to hijack it for just a second.
Do it.
I want to talk about two things. First off, in 2022, in late November, the Terminator said he was working on a direct sequel to The Running Man. Okay. Separate from what I am really looking forward to, which is the fact that Edgar Wright has gotten the rights to do a reimagining of the original book. And I'm talking about, I would love to see that. Sure, a film would be great, but man, talk about like a 6 or 8 episode, you know,
that'd be
Paramount
wild.
Or Amazon or whatever. That would be awesome.
Well, and what's also cool about that, at least that I've read, the goal is for it to come out in 2025,
which is when
the book is set.
Yes. Wow. So one of the things that I noticed about the book, of course, it's dated. Okay. We always talk about that. You know, now he wouldn't have to find a place to drop his videotapes. He would just upload them.
Stream them. Yeah.
But still, you could take a lot of that.
Yes.
And put things on it. One of the things that you could really delve into, which they don't really talk about in the movie, is the fact that the reason that people are watching these games and they're being fed all of this misinformation is because the government / big business is slowly killing everyone.
Right.
But pumping all of these chemicals. That's why everybody has breathing problems, all of this different stuff that's going on that Bradley, the young man who helps him get out of the city, opens his eyes to. And you could really delve into that.
Oh, sure.
As well.
And I think it'd be really interesting to jump this thing forward 40 years and think about how would you evade detection in the current culture where there are cameras literally everywhere? Because part of the deal in the book is that people are encouraged to turn him in.
Right.
And so there's incentive if you see this man to call the number and put the hunters on his trail. So to think about what that looks like in a world where literally everybody is carrying a camera in their pockets would be very, it'd just be fascinating to watch how they would try to evade being found in a world where it seems like anybody can be found anytime.
So here's my thought on that is I would kind of turn it on its head a little bit, like Death Race 2000.
Oh, yeah.
Is there had been a major event, let's say an EMP pulse, that has set us back many, many years. And so then you could still have that 1980 book writing feel.
Right.
And there's not all of those cameras and stuff like that. I think it would be very difficult to do that book today because literally you couldn't go anywhere without being seen. Nowhere, you know. But the fact that if you could turn on your TV, which is the only place that you get information now, there's no more newspapers that, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And here's this guy's picture every night. And here's all the horror stories about what he's doing. And yeah, turn him in and you get 100 new books. Kill him and you get 1,000 new books. But, you know, I mean, Edgar Wright is amazing. So I'm sure he could come up with stories.
Well, and Edgar, listen, because I know you're listening, give us a call. We've got ideas. We can help you make this thing go.
He's a huge fan of the Fae Five. Huge fan. So I got something for you. Did you know that there was actually a video game of The Running Man?
I did.
Yeah, it was on Atari.
Played it, but I remember it.
Commodore 64? Yeah.
But what we didn't ever get, and this was so incredibly early 80s, we didn't get the home version of The Running Man.
Oh my God, I saw that last night.
That he gives out, you know, to everybody that he talks to in the studio audience, gets a home version of the game, which is so stinking. One, so Richard Dawson.
Awesome. Oh, he's right. Because amazing.
every game show had the home version that you could play, but also just, so much a part of that culture of the time that obviously, even a game show like this that is about people dying, there's a home version.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, Jamie, we've scratched the surface. We've not plumbed all the depths of this. Before we go, tell everybody how they can find you and find Fae Five from fans.
Well, most of the time I am on X/Twitter or whatever they're calling it this week at Fave, the number 5 from fans. And everywhere else, I'm Fave spelled out 5 from fans. Find me, interact with me. You can download our podcast from anywhere that does a podcast, but mostly Twitter. I know that it's a big political hotbed, but I stay away from all of that stuff and just like to talk about movies. And
yeah, there are these fun little pockets still that are out there where we just talk about podcasts and movies and ridiculous things like The Running Man.
And I make TikToks now.
Oh, the world's not ready for that, Jamie. But it's still out there. You can also, so I've been on, we talked about, I've been on 6 times. We've talked about everything from classic TV dads to favorite Christmas TV episodes, lots of stuff like that. And if you go to okiebookcast.com/playlists, there's a whole playlist of other shows that I've been on besides the bookcast, including all the episodes of Jamie's show. So if you're not tired of the two of us talking, you can go hear more of it right there.
Then
you will be, absolutely. But go check out Fae Five for fans. It's so fun. It's such great stuff.
Thank you.
So, Jamie, thanks so much. This has been great.
I've loved it.
And folks, thanks for hanging out with us for Pages to Pictures. Be sure to reach out on social media like we've talked about at Okie Bookcast. Let us know what you think of the book and the movie. Let us know what we got right. Let us know what we got wrong. You can also recommend future adaptations. If there's something you'd love to hear us talk about, let us know what it is. And if you're really bold, volunteer to come on and talk about it with me. And we'll do exactly what we've done here, probably better than Jamie and I just did it.
No doubt.
I'll be back next week with another interview with the great Oklahoma author. So until then,
go find something good to read.